so much about it is that the builder in question, he did not tell me this, but the executive officer of the local home builders association points out that the builder is very badly strung out on this project, and while in a year or 2 years it may straighten up, it is very probable that my builder won't be around, that because he got strung out on this absolutely innocently, he financially may not survive to be around to build a house when things clear away. And I feel like I failed in this process to try to design a system that will allow things that were commenced a long time ago to go forward. Now, it may be that Chinook 4 would never be built if it were started today, and that's not the argument. The problem is, how do you get things like this through the process? I talked to the subdivider about coming in and appearing before the legislature, and he frankly said, my temper is too short. I would do you no service if I come in and talk about the process. On another lot in the last 2 weeks, he turned down the sale of another one of these lots, cash sale of another one of these lots, because he says, given the present status, I'm not sure I should take your money. All of this leads me to think that maybe we need to look at the exceptions process so very clearly and very expeditiously you could go back through the reason it's hung up, I guess, is because the Marion County Comprehensive Plan is being challenged in court. If the plan were acknowledged, they could go ahead and build, but because the acknowledgement was challenged in court and the final phases of this subdivision are involved in that challenge, if the challenge succeeds, we're back at ground one, and it is the county's belief that they probably can't get phase four and phase five through the process. It is possible that if you initiated a suit for a vested right in circuit court, 2 or 3 years down the line, the owner of the subdivision might be able to demonstrate he's got a vested right. But that is a several year process, presumably, where the subdivider has to initiate a suit against the county. The point in taking you through this is to suggest that it's our conclusion that you really ought to look at a workable exceptions process rather than try the marginal lands approach. Certainly the concept of marginal lands is a good one, but I don't see how you're ever going to get there with the legislation that you have before you, particularly when it is so restrictively drafted that you don't have any marginal lands in much of Western Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to testify, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to use this as a case on point on why we really need a workable exceptions process, and that would solve most of the rest of the problems that you're trying to address.
Thank you for your questions.
Mr. Chairman, I happen to be familiar with this because I worked on the comprehensive plan for Marion County. I must tell you, when we were asked, the county and the city were asked to go back and study this whole question, except they went back and examined every one of these parts. After about four initial turndowns, they went back and examined this entire set of circumstances. And probably the chairman of that commission worked harder on land use than any one person I know as far as a county official was concerned. And he, of course, made judgment on this and two or three other partials, but actually, the county's being challenged in court on something like 300 or 400 acres in total, 1,200 square miles that affected it. This is where this exception process is just simply not working. That's the case in point that you ought to understand. That's why I'm a little concerned myself, okay?
Thank you. Mike Judd, Barbara Bloch.
I'm Mike Judd, Assistant County Counsel from Clackamas County. And Mark, introduce yourself. I think most of the points that I was going to discuss today, Mr. Gerritsen's already hit pretty well, all us county council types think alike. I certainly agree with him on the comments about the farm use dwellings. We really don't like the standard. There was some discussion of what you'd have for an alternative standard. I think one possibility, at least partially answers that, is we have a provision in our ordinance where you either look at the minimum lot size, or if the applicant is able to prove that they have a more intensive use and it's a commercially viable use, then they can also get approval that way. So you have basically a double standard. The question of...
Could Senator Roberts... What do you mean by a viable standard?
I was sitting back there trying to remember exactly what our ordinance definition is, and I can't frankly. Another thing that was raised was the enforcement problem. I think Darrell really indicated, in effect, there probably is no perfect solution to that enforcement problem. That's the same situation you have really with any zoning. If you give some guy an approval for a 1 acre wrecking yard, he can expand the thing to 5 acres. What you have to do then is go through a rather torturous process, going through the courts, at the end of which the court is likely to say, well, we're not going to make him pull it out. I think basically you have to just assume that most people are going to be honest. They're not going to try and pull a fast one after they get their approval. And also the fact that Darrell mentioned about the tax penalties, I think that certainly makes some sense. The section 5 of the bill, which eliminates non-farm uses west of the Cascades, we're particularly unhappy with that. I think the non-farm use, basically non-farm dwelling provision, is, I think, was designed as a safety valve. When county goes through and we designate land, zone a DFU, we can't look at individual lots. We've got to take big chunks of land. If for no other reason than if you did look at individual lots, you'd be engaged in the dreaded spot zoning that planners and land use lawyers fear. I think what this does, what a non-farm use does, is if in that large area we've included a 5 acre rock pile, and that rock pile can be developed with a residence, can't be used for farm use, can have a residence on it without hurting any surrounding farm use, then there's really no reason why you shouldn't be able to put a residence on it. If you're not hurting anything, you're not hurting anything. I think the standards are tough enough. By the way, I agree with the standards that have been suggested in here, the rewriting of the NFU standards. I think that makes a lot more sense. They were somewhat confusing. But I think the non-farm use is helpful, and it's really not a wise move to try and eliminate something like that. Basically, the same situation as far as the non-farm divisions, which by Section 6 of the bill wouldn't be allowed anywhere in the state, divisions for non-farm dwellings. The same situation if a small part of a property that's isolated from any actual farming operation and can't be used for farm operations itself, there's really no good reason not to allow it to be split off, as long as it isn't going to interfere with somebody else in the foreseeable future. I think just one other point, the business about the life estate. I think we have a similar homestead provision to the one Darrell was discussing that in effect says, okay, you can do it once, and that's it. Another thing on that, I was speaking to some of our planning people about that, and their reaction was, when this retired farmer comes in and wants to live in his own house and sell off his farm to the farmer next door, perhaps turn it over to his son, and you sit down there and try and explain to him all about life estates, he's going to look at you and say, but I want to own my land, and I just want this little 2 acre piece. He's not going to really comprehend that, and if he does, he's probably not going to like it. And they are definitely against that proposal. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mark.
Marvin Gloach,
Oregon County Planning Directors Association and Lynn County. Just two or three brief comments, largely to follow through on comments that have been made. I think there is a real serious question about the elimination of non-farm dwelling units in the EFU lands in western Oregon. And just to elaborate, we have had instances where I think we've had fully legitimate requests for the establishment of non-farm dwelling units. Instances, the type of instances where this comes up most often is one, in situations where you will have a cluster of dwelling units which have been long been established and where there's infilling which might take place in an area which is really too small to be designated for or to be placed in some other zoning classification, but where you have a number of units that have been established over a period of time and they have requests that come in to add dwelling units in those particular circumstances. In addition, there are lands, as I think has been pointed out, that are zoned EFU, which really are, do not have EFU characteristics, and that's inevitable. I think that's already been pointed out. And so I think there clearly are circumstances left in western Oregon where the non-farm dwelling units in EFU lands are still appropriate. We had the county planning directors last December went through the joint land, the legislative committee's proposal with regard to establishing criteria for the placement of non-farm dwelling units. And I, at the initial hearing that you had with regard to this bill, we submitted a proposal to you. And our experience has been that the criteria that are presently within the law are relatively workable, and particularly the one criteria which is on page 7, lines 12 and 13, the dwelling or activities associated with a dwelling will not force a major change in or measurably increase the cost of accepted farming practices on nearby lands devoted to farm use. I think our concern is that that is a criteria which is difficult to obtain the information which is necessary to adequately make a judgment with regard to that type of a standard. The other comments I'd like to make, again, deals with the division of property. On in section 6, subsection 2, or line 30, page 7 of the engrossed bill, the term, the continuation of the existing commercial agricultural enterprise within the area is included as a basis for evaluating these type of requests, and our suggestion would be to eliminate the words the continuation of the existing so that it would read appropriate for commercial agricultural enterprise within the area, because we feel that there is a necessity, and this is something that county commissioners have talked about a lot too, a necessity to recognize that commercial agricultural patterns all change over the years, and that if the standard is limited to using the terms the continuation of the existing commercial enterprise, what you're doing is basically stating that you want of maintaining the present agricultural patterns without recognizing the continuing kind of change that takes place in agricultural development over a period of time. One other comment, which I don't know is appropriate tonight or not, but I will mention it at this point. We also previously had suggested to you that the lot of work. Sure, excuse me.
Could you explain a little more about the continuing change in patterns of agriculture taking place?
Well, I guess the concern that we have here is that as we read the language here, it basically states appropriate for the continuation of the existing commercial agricultural enterprise within the area. Taking a section of my county, Lynn County, as an example,
the southern part of our county is now almost exclusively devoted to ryegrass. Ryegrass has very large acreage, fairly large acreage requirements, and the soils in this area are generally class 4 Dayton soils. The only way that agricultural patterns in most of this area can be altered would be to would require a fairly substantial investment on the part of the property owner to put in for drainage and other improvements of this nature. And if you were to do this, then it's likely that the cropping pattern would change and that you might involve smaller lots.
So smaller than what?
Smaller
what
than
lots?
The prevailing lot size for, say, for ryegrass, that then has been traditional.
I guess I don't see the real relationship between that and what we're dealing with here.
Well, I think the end result is basically the same. I don't think that we're arguing with the intent. But we're saying that agricultural patterns do change, more intensive agricultural patterns.
I know they change the subdivisions a lot.
More intensive agriculture does take place in various portions of the state. And we're concerned that the language that's in here now does not recognize those changes as they would occur over time.
I'm also familiar with pieces of property that were wheat and that we turned into filberts in Yamhill County. And I recognize that kind of effort, but I don't see that would have the kind of impact on the definition that you're talking about. We're not talking about changing EFU or anything like that.
We're concerned about basically perpetuating a pattern which may of necessity have to change over time. Just by virtue of the language here. I think our intent is the same, but we're concerned that the language might provide some limits on future modifications in agriculture.
I didn't think it had anything to do with the practice. If you stayed within the 40-acre zone or whatever zoning you had in EFU, that would, you might have a problem if you wanted to split all those ryegrass places up into 2-acre parcels of strawberries or nurseries or something, but I guess that's the only example that I can see that would cause a problem if you were proposing to take them down so small.
Say, Robert.
Maybe.
I just wondered if that's what we weren't talking about. That in order, let's say, to take the example, if you had an area which had been devoted to other crops, and you found that was highly ideal for growing grapes. But the size of a particular operation that would be appropriate for growing grapes by one owner might be considerably smaller than the size of acreage required for the former crop.
Okay, but you're not proposing to alter the basic zoning, is what
no,
I'm talking about.
No, we're not talking about
this. Has to do with divisions. It says you can't create parcels for farm use. It would suggest that you can't change the parcels for farm use to sizes which would be inappropriate for continuing the existing commercial enterprise. If you wanted to, if you're defining that as growing ryegrass, you would have to continue parcels of the size to continue ryegrass, even though there was an opportunity to farm that for other purposes. I wondered if that was the point you were trying
to
make.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm really concerned about that we're reading broader attempts to change our entire land use policy into what the intention of this bill is.
The problem,
I guess I want to make sure, it's not my intention to change. Tell me what's existing now, then.
Okay, basically, I think the concern here is that if our county had a request was submitted in our county to review a proposed lot split, and we had to operate with a criteria appropriate for the continuation of the existing commercial agricultural enterprise within the area, then a literal application of that criteria, and we do get tested in that sort of way, would mean that we would have difficulty in, say, approving, say, a 160-acre split into two 80-acre pieces, if that was below what the pattern for the existing commercial agricultural enterprise would be in that area.
Is that true in the sense of the basic EFU zoning? How, if you have a basic...
See, I don't think this particular paragraph relates to the zoning pattern. This relates to the commercial agricultural enterprise pattern within that particular area, and that's the criteria under that applies here that a judgment would have to be based against, not rather than the EFU minimum lot size standard.
Yes. Senator, to look at it another way, I think what isn't too clear here is that this has the effect of overriding or being a restriction in addition to your minimum lot size. So you could have a 40-acre minimum lot size, the way we read this, 40-acre minimum lot size, and if you want to go to 160-acre split parcels into 160-acre pieces, if 320 is the existing standard in that area, and you don't need nearly that much because you're going to a more intense crop, then you probably couldn't do that under a literal reading of this, because
that's what I want to know. I want to know how far are we in fact dipping into the existing EFU basic standards and what's in place by counties and what the counties.
I think we're just adding a little more, another little level of armor.
Did you have anything in addition?
I was going to make one other comment, and I don't know whether you're going to cover this tonight or not, but our proposal that we had submitted to you previously also included some modifications in the lot of record legislation. I don't, is that a matter of concern tonight or later on?
Let me do this, Marv. Let me take the rest of the people here, and if we have some time, then we'll do that. Otherwise, we'll put some on now. Probably right. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Here. Dick Benner.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Benner, staff attorney with 1,000 Friends. Let me just begin, I didn't plan to begin this way, by responding to some testimony you just heard about the land division standard on page 7, appropriate for the continuation of the existing commercial agricultural enterprise in the area. That language comes from Goal 3, that's existing law. If that's incorporated into the statutes, it simply takes what's existing law in Goal 3 and puts it into the statute. So that would not be a change. The reason this was recommended, this change was recommended by the Exclusive Farm Use Task Force, of which I was a member during the interim. We made that recommendation to the Joint Legislative Committee on Land Use, and the Joint Legislative Committee on Land Use adopted it and proposed it in Senate Bill 234, and I understand, Agriculture for Oregon's bill incorporates most of Senate Bill 234. So this change is in 234, and it comes from the Joint Legislative Committee on Land Use. It is existing law. Now, the argument that you've heard about why perhaps it should not be existing law is that it seems on its face to impede the conversion of an agricultural area to a new type of agriculture. LCDC, when it adopted this standard, had that problem in mind. It does not have that effect. At least it need not have that effect. The type of situation that Mr. Gloge is talking about is fairly unusual, where particularly in the Willamette Valley, where the type of agriculture undertaken is of a single kind, and all the parcels are of a size that supports that kind of agriculture. As a matter of fact, one of the things I've passed out to you is a study of grass and grain farming in Linn and Polk counties. It's done by a fellow by the name of George Van Otten, and what you have is an article that summarizes his doctoral thesis. No?
It's back of the pet dog kills 33 sheep.
That's right. As a matter of fact, the pattern of parcelization in grass seed areas in the Willamette Valley, which probably has most of the large parcels in it, is that there are lots of small parcels, lots of opportunities for people to come in and try something new. I doubt that anybody would want to put grapes on a piece of land that's suitable for grass and grain because it's generally class 4 soil, it's very flat and tends to be very moist. But nonetheless, there are probably some areas that have grass and grain on them now that would be suitable for grapes. There's nothing to prevent a person from planting grapes or some other more intensive agriculture on a parcel that is large enough for a different kind of agriculture. The intent of the goal, this language in the goal, is to prevent the breaking down of existing parcels into parcels that are too small for the kind of agriculture that tends to be going on in an area now. And what that Van Otten thesis discusses is what's been happening in Linn and Polk counties over the years from the parcelization trend. It's working very much against the continuation of grass and grain farming. It's forcing commercial grass and grain farmers who have a lot of pressure on them to expand to purchase parcels that are very small and very expensive because they have a non-farm speculative value attached to them. It's forcing them to lease relatively small parcels, 20 to 40 acres, far removed from their base of operations, forcing them to drag their equipment to these small parcels. But that language is existing law. I'd like to talk about the four principal things I think that come up in these, in this part of the Agriculture for Oregon bill. The Oregon Farmland Protection Program provides for dwelling units in two basic situations, one farm dwellings and one non-farm dwellings. There are criteria both in this statute and in Goal 3 that guide the placing of farm dwellings and non-farm dwellings. If those criteria were fine criteria working well, and if the counties in their application of the criteria were applying them as they were intended to be applied, I don't think we'd have any problem here. I don't think Agriculture for Oregon or the Joint Committee would be proposing changes to those standards. But there's a problem, and the problem is the standards themselves are fairly vague, and the counties are not applying them as they were intended to be applied. In 1981, 1,000 Friends of Oregon did a study of exclusive farm use decisions made in 12 counties. We submitted that study to the legislature in 1981 session. That study was in part responsible for the requirement that came out of the post-acknowledgement law requiring counties to submit their EFU zoning decisions to the Joint Legislative Committee on Land Use in the interim between 81 and 83. When those decisions started to come in, we began to review them. The first decisions, there was a 4 months worth of decisions that came in between September of 1981 and the end of 1981. And I want to read a little bit from the study that we did about those decisions. We looked at approximately 265 exclusive farm use decisions involving farm dwellings, partitions for farm purposes, non-farm dwellings, and partitions for non-farm dwellings, four different kinds of decisions. Our findings were that out of those 265 decisions made in that 4 month period, 228 were made with improper findings. That is, the counties failed in one way or another to apply the law properly. We then went a little bit further and looked at the decisions made in five Willamette Valley counties. We chose Clackamas, Yamhill, Polk, Marion, and Lynn. We chose them because they tend to be strong farm counties. They're all in the top 10 or 11 producers in the state, and they have a large number of decisions day to day, month to month. Those five counties in that four-month period approved 142 new residences or land divisions in that four-month period. Of the 142 decisions, we looked at all the findings. It was our determination that 133 of them were made with improper findings. We went beyond the findings, though, in those cases, and we looked at every single decision to see whether or not it was correct or incorrect in our judgment